Hello and welcome to this podcast, exploring how institutions can create and implement a holistic wellbeing strategy and enable a more inclusive culture. Advance HE recently convened a group of senior leaders from executive teams and governing bodies to consider if and how wellbeing should become part of the organisation's strategy. I'm Kim Ansell from Advance HE, and I'm pleased to be here with my colleague Barbara Basser as we explore the management response and implications for implementation to that Sandpit event. I'm also delighted to welcome our guests, Vinita Suryanaranan, who is Director of Operations at the Royal Central School of Speech and Drama, and Paul Britton, Head of EDI and Colleague Wellbeing at Newcastle University. What a great job title, Paul. They're here to share their insight and experience and to respond to the reflections of senior leaders on this issue of growing importance in the sector and beyond the sector. The culture of the institution is a key factor in enabling the flexibility required by those responsible for implementing and delivering the strategy, and that includes the wellbeing strategy for key stakeholders, students and staff particularly. In the last 2 years, institutional cultures have pivoted and been juxtaposed between operating in an inflexible and unpredictable climate, often in either crisis mode or survival mode, while at the same time transforming online student learning and assessment faster than ever before. Vinita and Paul, to kick us off, what do you think is the biggest challenge for management in our institutions to implement a holistic wellbeing strategy?
So I think with so many increased challenges that are being faced around wellbeing, I think it's now incumbent to kind of move beyond what the model of support frameworks really are to kind of balance what is the necessary and essential challenge of study with the need for more therapeutic and a more effective intervention that is kind of capable of engaging staff and students. So, I mean, I think implementing a holistic wellbeing strategy immediately, I think, becomes challenging when we have many kind of soloed mini cultures that are floating within an institution. I mean, from where I'm coming from, I really see that as a very big challenge in kind of bringing the culture together and ensuring that there is cross engagement and there are people involved throughout the various aspects and there is less of a divide between the academic and the non-academic side of things. I think that contributes a lot towards facing these challenges. And also, I would say, matching the resources that we have to kind of the ever-growing organic growth that the institutions are facing. That's also becoming quite tough and challenging. And when I say resources, I mean, you know, infrastructure, financial, human, all of those aspects. So from where I'm coming, I think I see these small things as, they sound small, but actually if you put them all together, they're quite big hurdles to cross and face these challenges. So in a more generic aspect, I think that's where we're coming from in terms of what I believe are the bigger challenges that the institutions are facing at this point.
Thanks, Vinita. That's really interesting. And Paul, what are your reflections on that first question?
Yeah, I think I would echo some of that. I think particularly around those mini cultures, I think in an organisation the size of ours, obviously, we have three very large faculties. Within that, you've got multiple schools, you've got multiple departments. And then trying to create that strategic alignment across various job families. So you've got academics, you have professional services. Then you've also got our estates colleagues. Then within that, again, there's various subgroups. You have research institutes, etc. And trying to create a kind of real strategic approach. There's a lot of commonalities in relation to the challenges people will face in relation to wellbeing. But you also need to get under the skin of this from my perspective. I feel like you need to understand those kind of mini cultures, as Vinita put it, to really kind of get a sense of what are the individual issues in those particular areas. So what are the issues in relation to research culture? What are the issues in relation to learning and teaching? Groups on the ground who are in here regularly and were key workers through the pandemic, such as our estates colleagues, accommodation colleagues, a lot of those groups will not sit in front of computers like many of us do. So how do you communicate that wellbeing support and message to those groups? So there's that kind of top level strategic stuff around making strategic alignment throughout the organisation and understanding the areas that are kind of creating wellbeing issues in those different spaces. But also then you've got the kind of operational delivery piece, which is around how do you embed it in these operational groups and the support properly, where they perhaps aren't as kind of looped into what would be the standard way of communicating our wellbeing offer.
Thank you so much for sharing your insights, Vinita and Paul. Very, very interesting that you are highlighting the challenge of mini cultures. Obviously, universities are quite complex institutions. And I find it actually very, very inspiring that despite of those challenges, many universities in the UK, including yours, are investing time and investing effort to consider organizational well-being. And many institutions state in their policies and manifestos that well-being of students and staff is important to them. However, my question is, how is it really felt by staff and students? Do they feel that their well-being is actually important to their institutions? So I'm really curious to know your comments about it. Vinita, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you would think that coming from a small specialist institution, that well-being issues would kind of have a narrow framework. But in fact, we experience a whole range of well-being issues that come up, probably similar to what a larger institutions probably face. So, I mean, overall, I would say that staff within Central, they definitely feel quite inspired. But I think keeping that aside, one cannot kind of deny or ignore the fact that there is stress involved, there is workload pressures that come up. So I think it's important to note and also think that how staff really feel would kind of be defined a lot by how we perceive well-being. What do they think well-being means? I mean, is it just a state of being happy and, you know, physically and emotionally healthy? Or does it mean something more in terms of, does it relate to the absence of, say, a particular physical or psychological condition? Maybe they're feeling ill or, you know, there's distress and things like that. So I think how they really feel about well-being would really be defined by how they perceive well-being. And sometimes I also feel that there is probably a solution within the question itself. I mean, given the fact that there is a lot of increasing significance attached to creativity these days, and, you know, how can we better the academic student experience for all of our students, etc. So there may be another question that we could probably raise in that shouldn't the an effective academic challenge in itself, shouldn't that improve well-being? It's kind of intriguing because when I was talking to colleagues about well-being in general, these were some of the responses that were coming from of our academics saying being challenged academically to do more and deliver more kind of has a proportional relationship to their well-being because they feel more inspired, more driven, more motivated in that aspect. So maybe there's a trick that we're missing there. Is there a solution within the question itself, sort of thing. But I think it also a kind of robust response to really thinking about how staff really feel about well-being. There's a lot to do with balance as well. And when I say balance, I mean it can be balanced in different ways. It could be work-life balance. It could be balance within their professional work itself, you know, kind of the balance between teaching, research, etc. So all of these things kind of, I think, contribute to how staff really actually feel. Collegiality is probably seen as a component of well-being as well. And, you know, we're at that stage where we have to look after each other. Otherwise, you kind of end up creating another culture where everyone is just out for themselves. So I notice this a lot within Central as to how staff really feel about what well-being is, what the challenges are, what are the issues that they face. So I think they see it as being both individualistic as well as relational. So there is that visit comparison. There's how we placed against someone else. So that's the trend that I'm seeing within how staff and students to that extent are actually feeling about well-being itself.
That's really fascinating, Vinita. Thank you so much for this response. There is so much in it. Yeah, that kind of idea of trying to define how we understand well-being and as a first call, and then an element of being proportionally challenged, that's what I picked up, which is quite important. So feeling stimulated at work. Yes, thank you. Paul, what are your thoughts about this?
It's quite an interesting one because I took on this agenda about a year ago, and what I've seen over the last year is progressively more people engaging with the agenda. So we took well-being out of our occupational health service. We gave it a standalone team, which now reports into me. Obviously, as Kim mentioned at the beginning, I'm head of EDI and colleague well-being. So we now have a standalone colleague well-being team. And I suspect we'll come back to this later around communication. But I think for me, what I've noticed over the last year is the more awareness that we raise around the agenda, the more people say, I'm so pleased to see that the university is paying so much attention to this agenda. it's great to see all the activity what's happening. It's great to see all the support that was there. And in truth, a lot of the support has been there a long time. I wonder whether there's this piece where all this support exists across a range of universities, across the whole sector, but actually it's how that's being communicated. So universities, from my perspective, do value, absolutely value the well-being of their colleagues and of their students. And that student offer is obviously very visible through inductions and it's pushed through the students' union. But the colleague offer, I feel as though it perhaps doesn't get the attention it perhaps should have across the sector. And certainly at our place, I've noticed when my colleagues prior to me did some great work in occupational health, but it didn't have dedicated resource. Now that we have dedicated resource and a dedicated team, we've been able to really raise awareness of the agenda across the whole piece, which I'm seeing lots of colleagues coming forward now saying, this is great, it's great to see, et cetera, et cetera. But as I say, it was always there. Universities have always had that support in place. It's just perhaps not been as, I don't want to say well communicated. It's more a case of how it's landed or if it's landed at all in terms of it, kind of the recipient and the end user. So there's absolutely something there for institutions to do a lot more around how they communicate that offer. And by that offer, I mean kind of what's involved with their EAP providers, but what is the role of occupational health? How can managers better support wellbeing? Certainly there's one there around kind of opening up, destigmatizing conversations and creating a culture where you could have this openness in terms of discussion. And I think there's some points there as well about transitioning out of this pandemic. We're moving out of a time which has been extremely stressful for everybody, but we're certainly not through it. We're adjusting to new patterns of working, and it'll be a massive positive to some people, but we'll have well-being implications for others. And we can't lose sight of that as we continue to kind of progress with our work into the future.
Thank you. So it sounds like there is something there about how we communicate it and also whether staff perceives it's accessible to them as well.
Yes, absolutely. And what I would also say, there's a really important piece there, is we have to listen. We have to listen to colleagues across our organisations. We have to spend the time and go and listen to these groups of people and try and understand why they potentially wouldn't engage with an agenda, what barriers do they perceive as being in place, and how can we drop them? And what we've been allowed to do with the resource that we've invested into a wellbeing team is really spend that time with various job families and set up listening sessions where we can get that feedback and start to adjust our wellbeing strategy overall to kind of meet the needs of the whole population.
And I can imagine how just doing that, you know, going, asking questions, listening, how that really contributes to people's well-being, because it's a deeply, I think, ingrained need that we have to be understood, to be listened to feel important. And doing exactly that, going out, listening, asking questions, definitely provides that kind of feedback to staff. Thank you so much, Paul. So now I would like us to consider the sector's approach to well-being. So higher education mainly tackles well-being on a physical and mental level. You already started talking about it. So we talk about physical health, we talk about mental health. So far, we predominantly were talking about students. During pandemic, the focus started shifting more. We are now focusing on staff more, which is fantastic. However, it seems to me that emotional aspects and deeper aspects of well-being, such as alignment with our purpose and our values at work, are not necessarily considered when we are talking about well-being in higher education. And we talked about it in our Sandpit event, which we ran for senior leaders in the sector at the beginning of May. We asked them a question about how their decision making would change if they were making those decisions, you know, from a more conscious level, taking a human perspective, a more holistic perspective. Yeah, and we had mixed reviews from it. So I would like to know from your perspective, how approaching well-being only as a physical and mental phenomenon, how is that impacting well-being strategies, and how would it be different if we had a more holistic view on well-being?
I think the landscape is changing I mean, looking at well-being from just a physical and mental perspective, in some respects, is a start going into a direction that was probably ignored a few years ago. So, but although I say that, I think overall we can all agree that, you know, anything that's coming out of looking at it from just that approach is going to be short-lived, and it's probably one-dimensional if you're looking at it that way. But having said that, things are changing and there is involvement from senior leaders, and there is an acknowledgement from all around, institutional wide, about the fact that we need to align our vision and values into the core of everything that we do, and that would include our well-being. And I'm pleased to say that from my perspective, the In Central as an institution is taking things a lot more holistic at this point. We have a certain level of board involvement as well within the institution. And I think it will kind of create an approach that values the team and the individual for their expertise by aligning the entire well-being perspective from a more holistic angle. We're hoping that with the way we're going, it will kind of create an ethos that makes people feel trusted, makes them feel respected. And I think it'll also have the impact of doing it that way will have a massive impact on relationships. And relationships, as we know, is very key in terms of, and matters so much in terms of how well-being can be approached within an institution. I think the human element to it is such a salient factor that we need to ensure that we are giving it that much enough, credible amount of time and effort and investment into it. I think all of this is kind of premised on that sort of intellectual stimulation that we have, that will bring in that extra impact on well-being by having a more holistic view rather than, you know, keeping it very physical and very mental, because otherwise you'd also have a risk of isolation, which can bring in so many more other side effects and other challenges and problems that will come towards it. So by kind of aligning things with our values, with our vision, with our purpose, with our mission, we need to hopefully create that kind of atmosphere that is not of mistrust, that is not bureaucratic, and there is less mismanagement in that sense, if we kind of look at it in a more holistic perspective.
Yes, thank you so much. And yeah, I'm going to hang on to this notion that the landscape is changing. Thank you. Paul, what do you think?
Yeah, again, I would agree with a lot of the points what Vanita said. I think, interestingly, when we look at it, when I'm kind of reflect on this question, is when you think of the mental and the physical, it is almost, it does take it down to the individual and that kind of self-care piece around supporting mental health, supporting physical health. And actually, to really move the dial on this stuff, we do need to start embedding it through our culture and values work. And going back to kind of the investment we've made and where my team sits, we sit within the people engagement and culture section of people services, which allows us to kind of align ourselves to a lot of the development work going on around culture and values. And I think if we integrate well-being into culture and values, it becomes part of everyday decision-making from the start. It doesn't become a question of how do we look back and kind of deal with the well-being implications of a decision. What we do is we create an automatic thinking process that informs the decision-making from the start and says, right, what are the well-being implications and how can we potentially mitigate against those? And I think actually embedding that through the culture and values work across the whole sector and as we progress, is the way to which we can really change the dial on this stuff instead of kind of having to respond to the outputs of a decision, if that makes sense.
Yeah, so it sounds to me like actually putting the well-being in the center of our attention is putting more pressure on, well, positive pressure for the culture of universities to change and shift, to bring that alignment with values and purpose and mission and what it is we are doing and where we are going and how we can bring everybody on board on that journey.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think I completely agree about what Paul, you're saying about keeping well-being at the core of what we do, but also actually involving everybody from the very beginning stage in terms of actually defining what the values are, rather than giving them a piece of these are our values and now how do we align well-being into this, but actually having the bottom-up approach of, I mean, let's come together and let us decide what our values should be. And, you know, and I think that involvement at that very early stage probably solve a lot of problems in the long run.
Absolutely, Vinita. And I think that has to form part of this. And we've used this term a couple of times during this conversation around holistic strategies. And that holistic strategy has to be formed with stakeholders. And that listening piece, again, and having stakeholders build in from, as you say, from that ground up approach.
I'd really like to comment on that because it fits really well with the discussion that we had at the SANPIT event with senior leaders in terms of creating that narrative around well-being and how staff feel and the issue of evidence to share with senior leaders. Very often people are looking for evidence in the form of statistics, in the form of numbers, in the form of data, and quite often that just isn't available on the well-being issue. It has to be a narrative, it has to be something different, and I'm really interested in how we think about evidencing this issue differently to some of the other things that we evidence in our institutions. What tangible evidence do you think we can share with senior leaders which helps them to make sense of the well-being in our organisations and to understand the implications for delivering the organisational strategy? In particular, Paul, I know that Newcastle's got a very integrated approach to its strategy and to its performance measures and to how it documents evidence. And I'm wondering how it might work from that perspective at Newcastle in terms of fitting in a different narrative about evidence.
So our approach at the moment, where we're at the moment, is we're as you say, moving away from, how can we move away from what would be the traditional measures? Because this is not, you can't just look, for me, you can't just look at raw data. You can't just look at sickness absence statistics and draw information from there. Equally, you can't look at management information reports from your EAP provider and draw information from there, because in truth, the more activity that you put into your wellbeing agenda, those figures arguably will potentially go up anyway. You would have more people accessing, not necessarily the sickness absence stats, but you'd have people accessing your EAP more frequently. The more aware they become of EAP, by EAP, as I'm sure many of you know, as employee assistance program. So they can't be just your true measures of this stuff. And I think some of the things that we're exploring at the moment, and actually we've set up a small data review group around this stuff. So we've got our culture survey work. So we do work around our culture surveys, but what are the best wellbeing questions to ask as part of those surveys? But equally, not asking those surveys potentially on an annual basis of every 12 months, but more of a rapid temperature check in smaller bite sizes at more regular intervals so that they don't become too onerous. But I'm going to use the term agile, so we can be a bit more agile in relation to how we adjust to an organization rather than this kind of 12 month. It could be that 12 months from now, people are responding to something that happens in 12 months time. And then actually the 12 month preceding that, where they were, most people were, their well-being felt great, for example. Other things, and Vanita and I have touched on this, is listening to stakeholders. So we have a lot of well-being volunteer programs at the organization. So our well-being ambassadors, just ask volunteers. So it's understanding what are they hearing in their respective areas and how does that qualitative information inform what could potentially be an annual or kind of 6-monthly report that goes up in relevant governance structures. But again, the EDI piece as well, we can't be just looking at wellbeing in isolation. We have to be engaging with our EDI networks to understand how wellbeing is impacting the communities that they represent as well. And again, it informs this whole ground up listening approach to how we develop and approach our wellbeing activities going forward.
I think that's really helpful and certainly changes the dial in terms of understanding and offering others understanding beyond statistics. How is it working at Central, Vanita?
I mean, I would echo a lot of what Paul's actually said, because coming from a small institution with very limited resources, I mean, we have very few people in these, not a very big HR department. Obviously, there is the traditional methods that Paul touched upon in terms of the EAP and you know, looking at sickness absence days and things like that. But at Central, we've actually this year launched our very first staff survey, which is absolutely focused mainly on wellbeing. So the questions that we were able to design, well, in that narrative style that you've kind of explained, where we're going to get that information directly from staff about, you know, a kind of pinpointing and you know, bringing it down to what is the core issue, where do we really need to be investing our time and effort and making things in a more efficient manner. And I'm also completely in support of what Paul said about not leaving things to be done every year, but having those frequent checkpoints as to, you know, where have we come and what have we achieved in the last month? Even if it's a not 0.1% improvement, we still see that as a movement in the right direction. And at Central, we also have quite a few working groups where people from different areas of three different departments come together and we kind of meet on a very regular basis, whether it's monthly, quarterly, discussing what, are there any common trends? Are there any common themes that we're encountering? Is there anything that we can learn from them? And we are actually awaiting the results of this very first survey that we did that's been so focused on well-being. And once we get that, I mean, I think we have to all put our heads together again to see, based on the evidence in front of us, let's pick out one or two key points that we really should be working on. And all of this, like I said, keeping in mind that we are a small institution and we've got limited resources. So we've got the traditional methods of trying to see how we can be creative and bringing about more evidence and having the senior members kind of championing it and helping us take it to us or guiding the rest of the staff and ensuring that the message is kind of going through to everybody that this is taken seriously. And it's not another tick box exercise, you know, that sort of thing, that there, it is part of the core of what we do. And I would also actually add that getting unions involvement in the whole thing and, you know, the kind of working side by side with management and senior leaders, I think is also helpful to see that everyone is actually on the same page and trying to achieve the same thing. So that's where Central's position at this point really is.
I would absolutely agree again with Renita on that last point about involving unions and senior leaders and us all being part of planning this work going forward. And I think two points I wanted to add was, the first was around, you can draw a lot from not just kind of well-being surveys, but how do we align to things like research culture surveys and the well-being aspects that sit within those, or various other surveys or listening groups or whatever happens across the institution? How do we draw those kind of individual bits of learning from those that might actually end up being indicators as a potential longer term well-being implication for an organization? I haven't got a solution to it right now, but the other one is physical well-being. So we're talking about well-being right now, and one of the approaches I'm trying to embed, and we've discussed physical well-being on this call, is how can we better support the physical well-being of colleagues? We've got health inequalities and big ticket public health agendas. The NHS are kind of rolling out various things at various different times. But as organisations, we're almost reflections of the communities that we sit within. If you look across the job families and across kind of various activities, what we're trying to do here, one of the approaches we're taking is to start using the expertise that we have in our medical faculty to start running your standard health MOTs. And if we can get that off the ground, we can almost start to inform and do more targeted campaigns around some of those kind of bigger ticket public health type things, but also those physical health things that our organization, we might want to improve as an organization. So being a lot more targeted with our physical health agenda as well.
That's really interesting. And broadening that question about evidence, which you've given us some really, really interesting insights onto, about how we change the direction of evidencing, but also to think much more about stakeholders and how we're engaging them, not just students and staff, but the unions and partners that we're working with. I think it's a really important step in a direction of saying this is a holistic strategy, and therefore all stakeholders have to be involved in that discussion. So that's really inspirational. And it leads me to ask you a final question, really, around your aspirations. What would you like to see universities adopting, which would really inspire you to support an initiative or a new way of working?
I'm going to go back to, again, the point that I was talking to Barbara about earlier as well, about how the landscape is changing. So it's changing pretty rapidly. So there are so many external factors that actually have an impact on how aspirational we want to be. I mean, and something as basic as impact on our funding and what our priorities are. And I think what organizational well-being approaches that we can actually aspire for, I would say probably adopting a more overt approach to staff well-being, and also the necessity to look at student well-being as is, you know, going running in parallel. I think increased training and professional development that actually relates to personal well-being and kind of helping us to kind of increase the awareness that is around across staff and students and across all stakeholders. And I also feel aspirationally, if we can bring about some sort of reduction in anxiety for people, that any reorganization or change means redundancy or it's going to affect people's jobs. And, you know, especially coming out of the pandemic, I think that is a very big worry that is kind of involuntarily kind of seeded in people's minds. at this point and trying to reassure staff and all the stakeholders that some change is good and kind of how can we move towards reducing that anxiety that prevails amongst them. And I think overall, I kind of end by saying that having less of an ad hoc or piecemeal approach towards well-being, and like we've spoken about, you know, just ensuring that it is the core of everything else that we do, and slow steps that would take us towards that.
Really insightful, Vinita, thank you. And very timely to think about that issue of changing the culture around people's thinking and mindsets, that change creates anxiety and that change should be inspiring for people and encouraging for people and motivating for people. And sometimes it can be. So that's a great reminder. Thank you for that. Paul, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that we've discussed a lot of what I would like to see. And I think I think we've always started taking the first couple of steps on this as an organization, is this holistic approach, this real holistic approach that takes into consideration the views of the whole organization when planning our approaches to well-being. And I think also this being a bit more agile, when we talked before about these kind of more regular health checks within an organization, none of us saw the pandemic coming. And I think when things like that happen, to be able to adjust a lot quicker, having a holistic approach in place would help that. It would help us to be a bit more agile and having those quicker temperature checks around kind of data or however you want to place it in terms of how we're monitoring well-being. But the absolute key to all of this is this joined up approach. And I think Vinita mentioned it there around the student well-being piece, but it's not just the student well-being, but we've discussed it. It's that top down, bottom up approach, but also across occupational health, across student well-being, all those key stakeholders that form part of the delivery of an operational well-being model, all working closely together to make sure that we can provide the right support for all of our stakeholders is essential for the delivery of this work.
Great examples. Thank you. Barbara, what's your reflection on those aspirations?
Oh, thank you so much for contributing to this conversation. I think this is a very important conversation. Hopefully one of many we'll have about this very vital topic. And I think that colleagues in the sector will definitely find it inspiring, and we will start looking at how we can start expanding our thinking about well-being in higher education. And you've mentioned some really important points about making it central, strategic, holistic, bottom up, bringing everybody together. And my hope is that as a result of conversations like this, we will create more compassionate, more human, more healthy universities. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Vinita. Really enjoyed talking to you today.
Thank you.
Thank you.